Today's Taisho will be on case two in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the gate of no barrier. Case two is entitled Hyakujo's Fox. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a certain series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a head monk living on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Does a person of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?' I answered, 'No, he does not.' Since then, I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a person of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not?" Hyakujo answered, "He does not ignore causation." No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am emancipated from my life as a fox. I shall remain on this mountain. I have a favor to ask of you. Would you please bury my body as that of a dead monk?" Hyakujo had the director of the monks strike with the gavel and inform everyone that after the midday meal there would be a funeral service for a dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, "Everyone is in good health. Nobody's in the sick ward. What does this mean?" After the meal, Hyakujo led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening, he ascended the rostrum and told the monks the whole story. Obaku thereupon asked him, "The old man gave the wrong answer and was doomed to be a fox for 500 rebirths. Now suppose he had given the right answer, what would have happened then?" Hyakujo said, "You come here to me and I'll tell you." Obaku went up to Hyakujo and boxed his ears. Hyakujo clapped his hands with a laugh and exclaimed, "I was thinking that the barbarian had a red beard, but now I see before me the red-bearded barbarian himself." Mumon's comment, "Not falling under causation, how could that make a monk into a fox? Not ignoring causation, how could this make the old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Hyakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox." Mumon's verse, "Not falling, not ignoring, two faces of one dice, one die. Not ignoring, not falling, a thousand errors, a million mistakes." It's the end of the session. I simply can't believe it. Really, I mean, the more sessions you go to, the more rapidly they will pass after a certain point, you know. As I always say, the first 10 years are the hardest. It's true. After that, It's gravy all the way. Really. It's just, I look forward to Sasheen, and when Sasheen comes, I'm very happy. And then when Sasheen is ending, I'm okay, you know, but I wish it would go on. I'm sure not everybody has that feeling right now. Some people are counting the minutes, you know, and I understand that, you know. But I love Sasheen, and I could easily, you know, I could just, if tomorrow were like today, that would be fantastic, you know. And the day after that, sounds good to me, you know. we have to earn our livings, we have to be in the world, and our practice benefits from that enormously. But there's something very precious about this experience of Sasheen, I think everybody will admit. And now the Sasheen is coming to a close. Some people came into Dokusan last night and reported really wonderful breakthroughs. You know? So people are plugging away with their koan, and you know, it does happen. You know, like on day three of Sasheen, it's like the magic day. You know, you're thinking wistfully of getting in your car and leaving, and you stick it out. And as I was saying, you know, it's like that switch goes on. And then it's like, wow, thank God I stayed. You know, I'm so glad I stayed. And you know, people come in and say, oh, I feel so much better. And this is really great. And then, you know, what can happen is, you can answer your koan, or maybe you need to do more work. And what can sometimes happen, though, is that you peak, and then you sort of lose that momentum. This is not so uncommon, especially for beginners. And by beginners, I mean people who have done less than 10 years. you come to Sasheen. First day is as I described it, you know, you're thinking about your life. Day two, you're thinking, why did I come to Sasheen? Morning of day three, you're thinking, oh my God, what have I done? You know, maybe I can leave, you know. And then, you know, the switch goes on. And, you know, people come in sometimes the night of, you know, day three or day four, and they tell me, you know, oh my gosh, it's going, I'm so glad I stayed. You know, and you do get these people saying, people come in and say, holy smokes, you know, you were talking about the eye of the tornado, I'm there, you know, my pain is gone, you know, or people come in and say, oh, this beautiful energy, you know, this is, you know, however, you know, you go to bed night of day three or the night of day four, and you're thinking, oh, if tomorrow is even better than today, you know, it's going to be great, you know. But then you get up the next day, and instead of shooting out of bed, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, I'm so tired. And then you get out of bed, and you get onto the cushion, and it's like the pain in your legs is back, you know, or maybe it's even worse, it seems even worse, you know. Your mind, instead of being, you know, the night before, your mind might have been like a calm mountain pond without a ripple of wind. And, you know, sometimes you can go up to, even in New Jersey, we have these ponds, like Sunfish Pond, you know. The water is actually clean, you know, it's amazing. You can go up there and you can look down, it's alpine fresh water, and you can look down, and you can actually see on a sunny day, you can see the bottom of the pond. It's just such clean water. And, you know, your mind can be like that, you know, and you're in that lucid, calm state. And then you get up the next day and your mind is like muddy water again, right? And it's possible to be totally bummed out by this. And you can feel cheated, or, I mean, it's happened to me many times, you know. I mean, I've talked about, you know, that the famous time it's famous in my mind anyway, you know, the time I went to see Genki Roshi and told him I've done it, you know, I've conquered pain, and lo and behold, next day I was in agony. And for me, cold is a big problem. And the first time I ever went outside and the cold didn't bother me was toward the end of a sesshin. And we would all have to go out and do this ceremony outside in the freezing cold. And Genki would always just have like his robe on. And it was just like, it was like 20 degrees or something. And everybody, most people would just not try it. You know, they would just go, as we filed out, they'd all put on their parkas and stuff, you know. But Genki would just, he'd be, you know, going through the snow or whatever. And, you know, it doesn't seem to bother him. And so, you know, I would try it, and I would always just think, oh my God, I'm freezing my ass off. This is torture, you know. And at one time, I actually did go out, and it was like, this is a miracle, you know. I'm not cold. And it was just the same relationship you can have with your pain, you know. I was outside. I was wearing a robe like the one I have now. It had a cotton undergarment and the robe. And it was 20 degrees or something. And it was like the cold was there, but it wasn't affecting me. And there I was like in the eye of the tornado. I just felt, I didn't feel warm and I didn't feel cold. And it was really like, this is so cool, right? I just thought, this is amazingly wonderful. And I had that thought, well, maybe I'll never be cold again, you know. But, you know, next time I had the, you know, in fact, after the session was over, I went out and thought, ooh, it's really cold, you know, because I wasn't in samadhi anymore, you know. So what does this mean? Well, I mean, one of the things it means is that, you know, especially when you're just getting started, there's limits to your ability to concentrate, you know. You make a superhuman effort on the cushion, and you reach this peak, and it's beautiful amazing. And then, you know, you sort of run out of steam, and you sort of slide back down the mountain. And then the prospect of climbing the whole mountain again can be a little daunting. But there's another way to look at it, which is actually more accurate, you know, in my opinion. And it doesn't just apply to sesshin. You know, all of this, even though there's a great predictability to what happens to people at sesshin, generally speaking, the Zen life is governed by like a mysterious process. It's just the case. So you can be struggling with a koan for months, and all of a sudden you could answer that koan, and then you could answer another koan very quickly. And it's like, why did that happen? And in fact, you could be on a roll, you know. You could be stuck for a long time. And then all of a sudden, it's like the doors open. And of course, you could think, oh my gosh, from now on, I'm going to answer all my koans so quickly, right? You know. But then all of a sudden, it's like your power disappears. It's like Spider-Man 2. Remember that? That's one of the few movies I've seen, but Spider-Man mysteriously lost his powers, right, you know? So you're like swinging from the buildings with your Mu power, you know? You're thinking, oh, right, you know, nothing can stop me. And then all of a sudden you go crashing down onto the street. It's like, where are my spider powers, you know? And that happens, you know? There's a kind of a rhythm to practice. It's like waves. I really think it's like waves, you know. So sometimes you're riding a wave, and you're just in the Tao. This is what Lao Tzu meant. Sometimes you're in the Tao. You're going with the Tao, and it's like everything is coming together in this beautiful way. Now, it's not possible. It's just not. It's not reality to assume that it's just going to be smooth sailing from this point on. You know, somehow that mysterious energy begins to decline, and things become less auspicious. You know, things begin. You encounter some headwinds. You know. And it's easy at that point to get discouraged and think, "Well, this is all a fraud. This is all a crock." Or just to say, "Oh, this just goes to show what a loser I am." You know, I mean, that's a common human. So you blame yourself. What am I doing wrong? You know, it just shows I'll never answer any more koans. I'll never be any good at this. But that's a very, please don't give way to those doubts about yourself or about the process. This is a very sophisticated process, and there's a waxing, you know this word waxing, like the moon gathers fullness and then it declines. It's like there's a waxing and a waning in Zen, and it goes on and on. I'm not trying to make you feel better. I'm honestly speaking from my own experience that, you know, the big mind is the unconscious mind, is one way to think about it. And it has these mysterious processes. It has it has its own reasons, you know. And all of a sudden, you're on a roll, and then you're not on a roll anymore, and it's just like hard work. And if you don't do the hard work, nothing's going to happen, you know. But if you keep doing the hard work, you plod along and you plod along, all of a sudden you're on a roll again. This happens not just in Zen, but in many different areas where the activity is highly skilled and requires very sophisticated integration. You know, Zen practice is like very sophisticated activity. You're using your whole nervous system. You know, one of the reasons we don't sit in chairs is that we're using the intelligence of the whole body. And in ancient India, people worked out the possibilities for enhanced consciousness by experimenting with body posture. And so when we're sitting on a cushion with an erect spine and breathing through the hara, the dantian, and so on and so on, we're drawing on a very complex array of capacities in the human body. And also in the mind itself is quite complex, right? You know, we're not using this part of the mind, we're using this part of the mind. So it's like a very sophisticated kind of artistic activity in some ways, right? You know, it's like playing a musical instrument or painting, you know, or something like that. It's like many things go into this, and it's there's a kind of harmony. All these things have to come together with a kind of harmony. And if you do play a musical instrument, you know that, you know, sometimes it just for mysterious reasons, it they're not magical reasons. It's complicated. There is a Tao. Sometimes everything just comes together, right? And it's beautiful. This happens to musicians, you know. Musicians can practice constantly. And they'll say, you know, sometimes I sit down at the piano and it's like I'm just taking instructions from the universe and my hands are moving over the keys and there's no obstacles anywhere, you know. And then sometimes it's just like I cannot make a right move, you know. It's just like everything seems forced. Everything is a little, doesn't seem like totally on key, or, you know, the sequence moving from this to this doesn't flow. You know, and it's like, why? You know, I practice every day, but some days I'm in the Tao, I'm in the groove, and some days I'm not in the... And often, you know, there's a rhythm again. It's like, you have a dry spell or you're in a trough, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is great. I'm on the wave again, you know. So a lot of Zen practice is about, first of all, being present. You know, if you come to Sesshin, that's step number one. Nothing can happen unless you sit on the cushion, you know. And then you're sort of like making yourself available. You know, a few days ago I talked about my first time as a hitchhiker. I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and I decided that this was so cool that I had to do it. And I actually went out on the highway and I hitchhiked across the United States. And it was the coolest, up to that time, it was the most amazing experience, you know. Because I had been in military bases all my life, and I had never really been outside. I'd been to the university and, you know, town outside the military base or this town. And all of a sudden, you know, I went through New Mexico, I went through the Smoky Mountains, and it was just incredibly neat. And it was a good education for me in another way too, because I had been a very diligent student, and you know, I would come home from school and I would study, and I would go over my French translation assignments, and I would go over them until they were impeccable. I'd go down and ask my mother about nuances, or I would go over my trigonometry or my calculus. In nobody in my house could help me with that one, so I would go over that and over that obsessively. When I got to school, it was all there. You know, so I was very, very detail oriented. I didn't want to slip up. Well, you know, when you hitchhike, you can't do that. You know, you can't say, okay, I'm going from Seattle to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I expect to get to this place in Montana by nightfall. You know, you just stick out your finger. You know, you actually, people, you see that, you just hold out your thumb, right? It's just like in the movies, you know. You go out to you can't hitchhike on the interstate, but in Washington State, you can stand on the ramp. So you stood on the ramp, and sometimes you'd have a sign that would say, like, Bozeman. Or sometimes you had your backpack, you know, and you'd stand. You really can't probably do this anymore. It's not safe, probably. But at that time, you know, it was like a different country, really, very much so. And you go out on the road and you stick your thumb out, and some guy would pick you up, and he might be driving all the way to Montana. And, you know, he might be a trucker, or he might want just some company, you know. Often people just wanted somebody to talk to. They had a long ride. They didn't want to fall asleep at the wheel. You know, some people were so nice to me. They'd take me to dinner, you know, a diner, like on the road. But it's very precarious. You just don't know. You could get out there on the ramp and you could be picked up like this. Or you could spend hours there, you know. And you can't really read, you know. You have to stand there and wait for a car, and then you have to look like, please give me a ride, you know. But you can't be too desperate. You have to sort of look happy, like I'm. And you can't look resentful or angry, or they'll never pick you up, right? You know, you have to look like, you know. And usually, it would be good to have like a hat that was like a non-threatening hat. So Larry Sullivan had a golf hat, you know. He used to wear a golf hat like the guy on MASH. One of the guys on MASH used to wear a golf hat, you know. So he had a kind of an on-threatening golf hat, and I had like a baseball cap or something. And it made us look like we wanted to look like a couple of people who wouldn't harm a fly, you know. And so when I was by myself, you just try to look pleasant but sometimes you can be there for hours and you can get stranded, you know. One time I was hiking through Eureka, California, which is up in the Redwood country, and I got let off and I was there all night. And they dropped me off like in the afternoon, You know, when you look at the sky and you think, God, this is a great life, you know, to be out here on the road, free as a bird, you know, no man your master, you know. But that only lasts for a few hours, you know. Then you think, oh man, you know, why did I do this? I shouldn't have taken the bus, you know. And, oh, I'm sure something will turn up. It's always turned up in the past, you know. And then, you know, the sun goes down and you always carry the tent and a back, you know, back. I mean, I was mostly spending a lot of time hiking in the parks and stuff. So, you know, I was well equipped, you know, I wasn't desperate or something. And but then you get up the next day and think, my God, I might be here for a second day. And there were times where I actually did, like, trudge into the nearest town and try to get on a bus, you know, but I very rarely did that. And you know, but sometimes you just had to really wait. And but this was such a good education for me, because it, you know, I was used to I wasn't used to being flexible and receptive and open, and I wasn't used to being patient. You know, and you know, Zazen practice is a lot like hitchhiking. You know, you do have to be self-disciplined. If you don't get up and early and go out to the road, I mean, it's interesting, you know, when you're hitchhiking, you get up very early. Because if you're hitchhiking, you're a serious hitchhiker, you think, I should get up because I could be missing the ride I need right now, you know? That's right. So you get up very early and you get out there, you know, because you think, that, you know, I could be sitting here eating breakfast in this diner, whereas the ride to San Francisco is going by right now. So that haunts you, and you get out there, you know, with like a frozen burrito or something that you put in the microwave at the 7-Eleven, and then you just eat your burrito, you know, unobtrusively on the ramp, and you wait for that ride, you know. It's just like, Zazen is like that. You get on the cushion and you're waiting for the wave to come. And sometimes you have to wait a while, you know. And of course, it's painful. You know, you have your pain in your legs. And you can lose hope. You can become very despairing, and you can get down on yourself, you know. But you know, this will, you know, this is going to be like a present element. This is going to be an element or a thread in the fabric of your Zen life. It's just going to be. And it's not just at sesshins, you know, in your practice too, you can have a period where, you know, you sit on the cushion and not much is happening. You know, you sit on the cushion and it's just so-so, you know. But you keep getting on the cushion, that's crucial. And you keep trying, you know, you keep focusing your mind. But then, you know, one day you get on the cushion and unexpectedly it's like, oh my gosh, this is so great. This is so great, you know? And then there might be like a series of these sits where you're thinking, why did I ever doubt this? You know, this is so cool, this is so wonderful. But this is many things are like this. You know, writers talk about this process too. They'll have like a, quote, dry spell. And then all of a sudden it's like the floodgates open and, you know, they write, you know, 100 pages in a week, you know? So it's because this is a complex, like, symphony of activities that are all happening together, you know, to get everything to sort of line up, you can't make it happen. You just have to keep trying, and all of a sudden, actually, the mind is a complex system, you know, and the universe is a complex system. So it's like there's a tipping point, you know. It's like, you know, there's a pile of sand, and a little sand is sort of dropping off the edge of the pile. At some point, enough sand starts falling off the edge that the whole thing shifts, you know. Well, this is sort of like, you know, how, you know, the mind works, you know. You're trying, but all of a sudden it's like all these complex elements interacting come together, and there's like a tipping point, and then it all flows forward, you know. This is what Lao Tzu was a very keen observer of the natural world, and he understood that there are these rhythms in nature that, you know, it's not just the sea, you know, the moon is an obvious one, but there, It's like all of a sudden, you know, it's like it's winter, 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 winter. And you think spring will never come. And then all of a sudden you walk outside and the grass is already a foot high and it's got seeds on it. And you think, when did that happen? But there's like a tipping point, you know? So Zen practice is like this. In the life of Zen is like this. You're going to have periods where, you know, the energy seems to have deserted you, or the, you know, you suddenly are in a trough and you just can't get something going. And it's very important to develop a patient mind. It's very important to have a very patient mind. You know, I said yesterday that Zen people are very tough. You know, they're able not to be daunted by unfavorable circumstances. Well, Zen people also have to be very patient. They have to have like negative capability. You know, like Keats, the great poet, talked about how he could become a billiard ball. He could empty himself out, and suddenly he felt like he was rolling across the table. And anybody who's done Zen has had that experience sooner or later. You know, you hear the bird and you feel that that's coming right out of you, you know. Well, the point is you have to be able to sit there in a kind of empty expectancy, you know, or expectant emptiness, waiting for something to happen. And this, the mind is well prepared for this, you know, actually. You know, maybe at one time humans were often hunters or gatherers. And you know, you just sort of go along the road looking for food, and all of a sudden you find it. You have to sort of, this consciousness is just sort of waiting for something to turn up. You have to look or you'll starve to death, right? But there's something, this is not a bad way to live, you know? And if you're in a kind of open emptiness, waiting patiently, then all of a sudden, when the wave does come, you can catch it. You know, if you're too busy worrying about the next wave, if it's going to go right by you, you might not even notice it, right? So Zen people have to work through all kinds of adversities in life to practice Zen, among other things, because the world is not constructed to make it easy to practice Zen. But also, you know, you have to be willing to tolerate, you have to have the trust in the practice and in the process, and be willing to tolerate these troughs where nothing's, it's not the end of the world. It's not like you'll never have another good sit, you know. You'll never get that energy back. That's kind of like defeating yourself. But you have to cultivate a kind of patience. And we all do it. You sit on the cushion day one, you sit on the cushion day two, and something happens. But when the energy starts to wane, like the moon declining in size, you know, the moon's going to come back, you know, and you just, again, you have to be patient. You have to use that time to purify your body, mind, and heart. There's a bigger perspective to all this, though, and that is that, you know, if you really want to practice Zen, how shall I put this? This kind of patience can be cultivated best when you are in touch with your when you're living a life that's close to your true nature. When you're living a life that's close to your true nature. So, you know, if you're just doing something for the approval of others, or if you're just doing something half-heartedly, when things go wrong, you can have a lot of self-doubt, you know, and a lot of, you can be very bitter and disappointed. But there's another kind of there's another way of life, if I may say, which is following your true nature. You know, when you're not doing something because it's approved of by others, you're doing something because you really have to do it. I think that you have the courage, and the you have the proper spirit to deal with. You have the confidence and trust to deal with these periods of when the energy doesn't seem to be there. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's like, you know, some people just, you know, if their parents want them to become a doctor, they become a doctor. And they may not really enjoy being a doctor. It's just what everybody told them to do. But sometimes you do things because you have to do them. Maybe, you know, I've talked about the fact that I know a lot of people who are artists, and they don't make a lot of money, but they're doing what their true you know, they just had to be artists. They had to be. And maybe people said, don't become an artist, you'll starve, you know. And indeed, some of them have, like my brother-in-law, he's a really great sculptor, but he has to do like industrial jobs, you know, to pay the bills. I don't think he has any regrets, because when he does his sculpture, he really is, acting in accord with his true nature. And when you're in accord with when you're acting from your true nature, you know, you're not so daunted, you're not so shaken by those dry periods, you know, because we all have them. You know, I was doing Zen practice for a long time, quite unsuccessfully. And for some reason, I didn't quit. And I didn't know why, but I couldn't quit. I couldn't. You know, everybody else was answering koans like crazy. You know, there was a guy in our group who actually is now the abbot of the temple that the Seattle Zen Center later became. And one time he was telling me, how he'd answered like three or four koans in one sesshin. He was laughing, he was having a great time. Like, it was like he'd just come back from Vegas, you know. And then I rolled again and another seven came up, you know. And again, what do you know? Is that something or what, you know? And meanwhile, I couldn't get anywhere with my practice. But I didn't quit, you know, and I know now that I didn't quit because I was acting on it was my heart, my every atom in my being was telling me to do this, you know. And there was a part that my small mind was saying, why are you doing this? You know, don't you have enough stress in your life already, blah, blah, blah. But my heart, my whole being cried out to do this, even though I wasn't successful at it, you know. So, you know, at some point I realized I'm going to do this no matter, even if I don't answer another koan. You know, I'm going to do this if I am, I'm going to follow this path if I am reborn as a fox in 500 lives, you know. This, I think, is a personally, I think this is a good way to live. I really do. Once you're in touch with your true nature, you're doing what you know you have to do. You don't let these periods of dryness or mysterious waning of the energy throw you, because you're being true to a deeper impulse in yourself. You know, one of the interesting things, and I'll stop in just a minute, but one of the interesting things about Zen practice is that there's always another door to open. The universe gets bigger and bigger, your life gets bigger and bigger, but there's always another door to open. And that could either be very discouraging or it could be incredibly exciting. So, you know, you can be struggling with a barrier in yourself and you can work through it, and then lo and behold you discover another barrier, you know. And that could be discouraging. You say, when will these barriers end? You know, when will I be done with this? But the real question is, are you doing what your true nature tells you to do? And if you are, then there might be infinite numbers of barriers. Infinite numbers of barriers. And in fact, you know, we take a vow every day, twice a day, but not necessarily consciously. I mean, we recite these sutras. Sometimes people don't even look at what they say. But what they say, the four great vows, Wei Nang's four great vows, says, I will keep doing this, not just until I'm enlightened, but until every sentient being is awakened, and until all the universe's knowledge is exhausted. You know, the Buddha once held up a handful of leaves and he said, this is the human understanding of reality. And he said, that forest is reality. So we make a promise. We say, I will not stop until I've touched all those leaves in that forest. You know? So that's the vow we take. You know, we might not mean it. Now that could be incredibly discouraging. It's like I open this door, another barrier. But actually, it could be really wonderful. It's like there's no end to this process. Now, on day five of Sesshin, that could seem like a nightmare scenario, right? What? No end. Well, there is a little end. We get to go home at the end of the day. Right? But on the other hand, if you decide to keep doing Zen, there's no end to this process. Now, that could be terrible, but if you're doing what your true nature tells you to do, it's heaven. It's heaven. You know, if you love painting, it won't be the case that you one day go, well, that's it. I'm through. I've exhausted painting. That would be like a nightmare. You know, what you want to do is keep encountering new problems, new possibilities. And so what used to be, you know, a beginner in an art form can get stuck with some kind of a problem. And it just seems terrifying. Right? It's like, oh crap, you know, how do I solve this problem? But an experienced person in art knows, you know, that's the opportunity to create new kind of art, you know? And so you actually want to look for those. Science is like that, right? You know, you don't keep repeating the experiments you've already done successfully. You look for new things and opportunities. Really, actually, you look for opportunities to fail, because that's where something can be learned. So basically, you're actually, you know, you're constantly looking for a new obstacle, and every time you go through that door, it's like the universe gets bigger. Your universe gets bigger. But you won't do this. You won't be able to live this way if you are worried too much about the dry spells. You have to trust, please trust the process. You know, that energy, you didn't expect it to come the first time, right? Most people come to Zen out of curiosity or, quite frankly, because they're unhappy. And they, you know, nobody comes to Sesshin quite knowing what it's all about, but, you know, that day three or day four experience where you're up on the mountain peak is pretty beautiful. You didn't know about that. I said it was going to happen. When it happens, it's pretty cool. You know, it will come again. You know, you just have to have negative capability. You just have to have the ability to be patient and trust. Yeah. And if you do these things, your life is going to